Hello, everyone, and welcome to this discussion on the implications of the fall of Bashar al-Assad and what this represents as a next step for Syria's Christians. I felt compelled to talk about this subject, considering that Semir Gog, my guest here, and I talked about this topic extensively a few months back on a stream called Towards Extinction as part of our History of Today series. So there's been a significant development, and interestingly enough, if you go back and listen to that conversation, you'll recognize that many of the elements, the themes we brought up, have unfortunately sort of been realized in how events have transpired in the Middle East. Indeed, I'm reminded of one quote that I brought up, which was an oft-mentioned statement or sort of a political slogan during the original Arab Spring in 2011. Alawites to the coffin, Christians to Beirut. We'll get into the implications of what that really means. As of me saying this, the Organization for the Liberation of the Levant, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, has reached the much venerated Wadi al-Nasara, the Valley of Christians, cutting off Christian refugees and the Alawite heartland on the Mediterranean coast from Damascus. Bashar al-Assad has resigned and fled to Moscow. And the HTS has established a Syrian Salvation Government. The Syrian Arab Republic, which was established in 1963, has fallen. So, Semir Gog, first of all, I would like to introduce the fact that you did a stream recently on your channel, which was your immediate impressions as events were unfolding on the night of the 8th, a couple of days ago. So I would advise everyone to go out and check that video and Semir Gog's channel in general. Indeed, I'm sure people who are familiar with this channel are very aware of who you are. And I'm very fortunate and happy to get you back, considering this was a very much spur of the moment thing forced by current events. But after having introduced yourself, I'd like to ask you the question, what did the Assad regime government represent to Syria's Christians?
Well, thank you very much for having me. The stream, as you said, was posted as events were unfolding. And I woke up the next morning to discover that Syria was gone. It's been gone for more than a decade now, but officially the government had fallen. And it's a real live mess. I don't know that there's much I need to say in introduction. People can find my channel under Semir Gog, spelled just like the crazy name here. I focus on geopolitics as well as, you know, throwing in a few other things, occasional streams on bans or on esoteric subjects or, authors like Robert E. Howard. So it's a mix, and you can find it over on my channel. Yes, very happy to be here. And I should also say that trying to figure out what's going on in this part of the Levant, and indeed all portions of that the coast there, it's very difficult. I'm sure there are all kinds of intelligence services and the rest who, funded by states with all kinds of full-time analysts who have to scratch their heads. So
yes, you asked me on to that stream you did originally, and it was very late at night my time, and I had to rescue myself, admitting that I had no idea what was going on. Nevertheless, I enjoyed your impressions very much.
Well, yes, thank you. Here, I just want to emphasize that it's very difficult to see or understand what's going to happen because of the number of people with their fingers in this bloody pie. But in terms of the specific question to get started, as I understand it, the Assad, whose family had been in control there for more than 50 years, he comes from an Alawite minority, not to be confused with the Alevis in Turkey. They are a Shiite group that in some ways similar to the Druze plays their cards very close to their chest in terms of what their beliefs are, and we certainly don't have the time to get into it here, but they're a minority that's been present for quite some time on the coast there, and because they are a minority, Assad's government, based on the model set by his predecessors before him, meaning within his own family specifically, built a coalition based on the idea that the Alawites would protect minorities. And by the standards of the region, to a considerable extent, they had done so. And so there had been a certain amount of, the Christians in Syria were allied with the Alawites and looked to them for protection out of necessity. I think that's probably the best way to gloss it quickly. Would there be anything you'd add as you know more about the region and about the situation of the Christians?
Well, if everyone looks back to that stream we did, one of the conclusions that we both came to was the fact that because Christians had more or less been not just neglected by the West, but it seemed that Western policies, by Western I mean NATO, Europe, and the United States, seemed to be actively going against the interests of Christians in the Middle East, it led to this bizarre situation where Christians, whether they be Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, Miaphysite, Nestorians, what have you, were drawn into the arms of various Shia aligned or quote unquote sort of Shia backed secular governments in the case of Bashar al-Assad. And one prediction you made was whether Iran would actually assume the mantle of de facto protection over these Christian groups. I think it's fair to say that that prediction will not be borne out. Nevertheless, it was an interesting consideration to make because it informs a lot of what the Assad government represented. Now, I'm not going to gloss over this and try and paint a rosy picture of the Assad government. There are many serious glaring issues with it. But to point this out, it was informed by something called Ba'athism. And another thing that I've been at pains to talk about is this idea of Christians being able to reconcile themselves with Arab identity, Arab nationalism, and of course, more particularly, Syrian nationalism. The idea that Christians and Muslims can both be Syrians. And this is informed in the whole idea of Ba'athism, which in Arabic means Renaissance, effectively. It was an idea formulated in the born out of the ideas of the Naka in the late 19th century, which is this aspiration for a cultural renaissance of Arab civilization based on a secular mold in following with the ideas of the French Revolution. As it so transpired, the Arab Republic was formed in 1963, and then Hafiz al-Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad, came to power in 1970. It became a military dictatorship. And interestingly enough, as we've mentioned elsewhere, in terms of empire building and imperial diversity and minorities, the whole nature of the Assad-Ba'ath's dictatorship was very conducive to this idea of quote-unquote secularism and protection of minorities because the incumbent ruling elite were minorities. Emphasis, Alawites to the coffin. Why Alawites to the coffin? Because Hafiz al-Assad and the reigning clique were Alawites. And so against the prevalence of the minorities, the Christians, which before the war in 2011 represented around 10% of the population, the Alawites, which I believe represent about 20% of the population, and other groups such as the Kurds and the Druzes, such can form a coalition around a core identity, which is that of the Sunni Arab population in the center of it. And so in terms of Christians being able to realize their role within the Assad regime, they could look at it essentially as a counterbalance to whatever alternative there was in Syria at the time. And if you look into the statements made by the Syrian patriarchs, just to emphasize this in terms of why this is so significant in terms of not just in terms of the humanitarian cost of this, but just in terms of Christian history. There are 7 resident patriarchs in Syria. 9 nominally preside and have their headquarters in Syria. This is indicative of the fact that Syria is in many ways the heartland of the ancient Christian church or the Levant in general. The Patriarch of Antioch is the church that was started by St. Paul. It has its offshoot in the church, which is now based in Damascus. And even as the number of actual adherents to Christianity in Syria leave or are killed, that Christian heritage still remains. And so one can't overstate the fact that if Syria falls in the sort of similar manner to Iraq, it will represent a calamity for the history of Christian civilization. And I bring in Iraq also explicitly because that's one point of reference. I mentioned the idea of Ba'athism, the idea of the quote unquote secular Arab enlightenment, and how this effectively evolved into dictatorships formed around the cult of personality. This happened in Syria. And of course, it was also aligned with various Shia-backed militias. And of course, that then fed into the civil war in Lebanon. But of course, there is a concurrent regime in Iraq, which is only appropriate because both Syria and Iraq were products of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. In Iraq, of course, we have the regime of Saddam Hussein, which was roughly contemporaneous, in fact, almost entirely referring to the dates, Saddam Hussein vis-a-vis Hafiz al-Assad. Of course, he was overthrown in 2003 during the Iraq War. And following that, the status of Christians in Iraq went from bad to worse. And during the ISIS insurgency a few years later, which also massively affected Syria, hence was called the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, we can almost look at Christians in Iraq is facing an extinction event, which given the fact, again, there is an ancient contingent of Christians in Iraq is something we discussed in the previous stream. But I can't help looking at this and seeing the parallels and seeing what will essentially come out of this, because as we both mentioned, Syria is a hodgepodge. I mean, if I'm going to actually quote the head of the HTS, Yanani, in terms of his attempt to woo international opinion and assuage the fears of various notables, including bishops, he went out of his way to say, if I can find the exact quote, that it was a melting pot, again, emphasis on that term, for civilizations and cultures, and that the intention of the new Salvation Government was to respect cultural religious diversity. Of course, when previous governments make that, of course, it doesn't tend to go very well. But the reason I find this all very disturbing is that there are so many echoes of this in the history of Middle Eastern Christendom, because this comes back to the whole basis of the Millet idea and the whole basis of the Covenant of Umar, which, of course, you're very aware of, Semiagog, which is the stipulations for how Muslim powers deal with Christian subjects, which are tolerated as part of the so-called group, the Dhimmi, the people of the book. Nominally, Muslim rulers are there to defend Christian populations, albeit Christians have a lower status within Muslim society. Just to summarize, there's more information on this channel you can find to flesh that out. But essentially what the issue is here is that Christians have to effectively force themselves into a subservient position dependent on the whims of the secular whims of Arab governments or Muslim governments more specifically. Sometimes, again, it's in the interest of stability and prestige of various Muslim rulers in history to support their Christian populations. Sometimes they go completely against these provisions of the Covenant of Umar. And sometimes it becomes a matter of there is no stable Muslim authority within a region which can defend or even enforce elements of this Covenant of Umar, the protection of Christians. And if you look at the history of this region, indeed, I was discussing the elements of the Sipho, the putting to the sword of the Assyrian, Chaldean, Nestorian peoples, and focusing on the idea that throughout most of their history, there was no stable central authority from which the Christians could appeal to. There was no millet established in that region. And so even if we have the HTS coming in and talking about religious diversity, and effectively these are again remnants of Al-Qaeda who have rebranded themselves. If they come in and they represent themselves as protecting the Christians, even if you have the real intention of doing that, which I don't, which again, we have to take that with a pinch of salt, we have to go back to this idea that it's not simply enough to have the commitment, one needs the power to be able to enforce it. If you look to the hundreds of thousands of people who've died in Syria over the last 13 years, so much of it has not been systematic when it comes to the attacks on Christians. So much of it has been the result of low intensity conflict, basically just banditry, raping, and looting. You mentioned how the Assad government of the last sort of 13 years, there's barely been a government. Well, there's been something resembling a government which has just been holding this whole thing together, backed by Iran and backed by Russia, and in the latter days trying to appeal to legitimacy by appealing directly to the Gulf states. But ultimately, you go from a incredibly fraught situation in a tenuous hole by a government which espouses all of these ideas of minoritarian rights and Ba'athism, and then you come to a situation where you have a much, much weaker government which presents itself as Islamist, that doesn't even have recognition as we're speaking of this. And in terms of looking at this from how things proceed from here, just to put this generally, I think we could possibly see Syria turning into a Somalia or a Libya, in which a similar situation has happened, albeit unlike in Libya, Assad wasn't murdered and mutilated, he fled the country, in which there is no centralized respected authority. I mean, as you know, the Americans, the Turks, and the Israelis, who are basically now the guarantors of whatever situation is now going to emerge in Syria, have destroyed any independent fighting capability for the Syrian government to prevent it falling into the hands of people who are still prescribed terrorists. And so the whole notion of Syrian sovereignty, the idea of Syrian borders, is being made a nonsense. Turkey already occupies large areas in the north. It has a vested interest in destroying the PKK and quashing Kurdish separatist sentiment, which has been completely sort of in full force in the northeast. While Israel is pursuing, I think one of the euphemisms I saw, expanded security or something, extended security measures, something like that, i.e. the Israelis are marching out of the Golan Heights. And there's even some speculation that they might go as far as Damascus. I don't necessarily believe that, but they're definitely using this opportunity to violate Syria's borders and press as far into Syria as possible. So going back to this original conception of the relationship between Muslim rulers and Christian subjects, if you do not have the provisions in order to basically enforce a stable settlement to protect Christians, again, from other more radical Muslim tribes or what have you, it seems that the situation in Syria is going to devolve into a pure tribalism. You know, we might even have a resurgent of ISIS. There's already elements of ISIS people sort of coming in and resuming their attacks. Indeed, one of the reasons that many Christians found appeal to the Assad regime is the fact that Assad made a stand against ISIS and protected Christian groups in particular from the encroachments of ISIS. So yes, I'm obviously not painting a pretty picture here. You know, obviously the Assad government wasn't great by any means. And I think this is an interesting opportunity actually to bringing the statements of various Christian prelates, because I'm finding this rather fascinating, because there was an idea that came to me, which I wasn't so convinced about early on, but the more I read into it, the more I actually think it has some substance, which is this idea that some Christians within Syria now are going to have an even greater stigma attached to them, not just because of their association with the Assad regime, but also because of their association with Russia in particular. For reference, I mentioned all of those patriarchal sees, etc. The actual body of Christians in Syria in 2011 was roughly around 1.5 to 2 million people. Now it's roughly around 250,000. The population has been utterly decimated. Many of them have gone to Cyprus. Many of them have gone to Lebanon. Many more have gone to Europe. So there isn't really that much of a Christian population to decimate. I mean, it really is a case of, is Christianity in Syria going to be facing an extinction event? And because of that, so many of the patriarchal sees have supported the Assad regime, believing it is the best source of stability. But there's another element, like I said, the Russian element, which I'm going to bring in. Of course, Semyagog, you know about the Treaty of Kolchak, or Kosh, if I'm remembering that correctly, I can never pronounce the Kuchuk, the Treaty of Kutchuk in 1774, which recognized Russia as being the protector of Middle Eastern Christians, in particular Orthodox Christians, a right had also been afforded to the French within that region. Well, within 2014 and onwards, there was an attempt made by the Patriarch in Moscow to foster links with the Patriarch of Antioch. The Patriarch of Antioch is still the same man. It's one John the X. And so there was all this talk when the Russians were cozying up to the Syrians about restoring or rekindling this old alliance where Russia comes in and protects the Eastern Christians. And I have to say that this seems to be very much an initiative led by the Patriarchal See in Moscow. It does not seem to be something which seriously informed Moscow, as in Putin's policy towards Syria at all. When you look at Syria's Putin's foreign policy towards Syria, I think it's very fair to say that it basically is following in the sort of post-Soviet third worldist sort of state and very much bound by secular interests, not religious interests. But nevertheless, that's an element which was very visible to alert Christian Orthodox who are, again, aware of that historical connection, aware of the civilizational significance of Syria and wanting to use this alliance basically as an opportunity to expand upon this. So when you look at who are the Christians being targeted, I find it very interesting that it seems that the Greek Orthodox are the ones who are most terrified about the implications. Since the overthrow of the government, there has been a concerted push by many Orthodox prelates. So for example, the Archbishop of the primary Archbishop in Greece, the Primate of Greece has come out, Hieronymus has come out and focused essentially on this calamity which is going to befall the Christian population there. A bishop in Cyprus has done the same. Even a bishop in Albania is going further. But like I said, these are very much votes of moral support. This can't actually translate into hard material support for the populations there. Really, you can say, if anything, it represents a cry for help. And many Greek Christians are, again, spreading stories effectively of infringements against their rights already taking place. So that's one element. And I think the Russian angle could really exaggerate those attacks on that particular group. And then you come into the Catholics. I'm going to read a quote here because I found it really quite, I found it funny. I know I shouldn't say this, but I found it funny. Someone went out to interview a parish priest in Damascus, and he was one Fyrus Lufti. And he was quoted as saying that the fall of the regime is a gift that comes to us on the feast day of Mary. It is the birth of a new Syria after 53 years of a dictatorial and bloodthirsty government, that this is a time to represent Syria's rebirth. This is a time where the people will help to retake power, where we will see a real and definitive rebirth, where democracy and human rights reign, and where Syrians from all regions, ethnicities, and denominations are respected. You can say again that actually harkens back to this ancient idealized form of Syrian secular nationalism, the idea that this isn't simply a moment for Christians, but this is a moment of Syrian self-determination, ignoring the fact, of course, that there's almost no opportunity for any quote-unquote liberal democracy or any such institution to arise out of the situation. I find it interesting that there is a sentiment among various Catholics that is in sharp juxtaposition towards what we see from Eastern Orthodox communities. There was another quote from a Armenian bishop within the city of Aleppo, Armenian Catholic sects. There are about, what, five or six different Catholic denominations within Syria itself, saying that not only have I received assurances, but our situation will be better following the fall of Assad, effectively believing, again, this was a positive outcome, not a deleterious outcome. And then you see more reserved Catholics, such as the Archbishop, Apostolic Vicar of Aleppo, one Hannah Yolov, basically thanking the situation, be thankful for the situation that it basically had taken place relatively quickly and with minimal loss of life in the grand scheme of the vast casualties that we see in the Syrian civil war. But the most telling quote of all of this, because I think all of these comments either come from a position of a complete detached reality in the case of the priest that I referenced, in essence an attempt to stir up and motivate the population not to fall in despair, in which you can understand the actions of the words of the bishops. But I think the most telling quote from the Catholic perspective is from one Cardinal Mario Zanari, who is the Apostolic Nuncio to Syria, which is effectively an ambassador. His position is fascinating, the fact that he was appointed nuncio in 2008. So he has been with the Assad regime for the majority of his existence. He was one of the few officials connected to the West who was in talks and had links with both opposition groups and the Syrian government during the Syrian civil war. And after seeing what's happened with Assad, I mean, he's basically not pro-Assad at all. He had his feet in both camps, effectively, as you can say, with a large section of the Catholic population in Syria. But his assessment was that following 14 years of conflict, that this result meant that hope is dead for the country. So you see all of these sort of elements and the Christian sort of response to this. But I find the fact that it is the papal nuncio himself that came to that conclusion that I think is probably the most damning indictment, given that he is the most experienced in terms of understanding the relations between all of these groups, and he doesn't have a particular flock or a diocese to administer to. And I think the great Hail Mary for Catholic Christians, not for Orthodox Christians, who, like I said, can only appeal to the Greeks now that the Russians have lost, the great Hail Mary for the Catholics is, again, this makes me laugh, the idea that Macron will be our savior. The idea that this will be a restoration of the departure to Syria in the 1860s, where Napoleon III will come and strike down the Druzes who are attacking the Christians and the Maronites, and we will reassert France's role as the protector of Catholics everywhere in the Middle East. That seems to be the great Hail Mary. Oh yes, Assad is gone. But we now have the prospect of Macron assuming that Napoleonic role. But yes, I've gone in a lot there, and I'm aware, Semigog, that I haven't allowed you to speak, but those are various elements that I wanted to draw in, focusing on what the individual Christian response was from various dioceses and across denominations.
Yeah, it's a frightening picture. You point out that it's the nuncio himself who seems to have the most sort of clear-eyed, if grim, vision of what the circumstances are. But I myself was looking around for quotes from some of the religious authorities today prior to our stream, and it's interesting to see that this same person you mentioned, the Hanna Jalouf, who's based in Aleppo, if I remember correctly, as you said, you know, this, the Catholic news agency is carrying quotes from him, which are a bit different from what the nuncio had to say. And, you know, just to quote one of them, to reinforce this sense of a ridiculous disjunction from reality. And at the same time, you could interpret it differently and say that it's representative of utter subjection and fear for one's life and for the life of one's flock. The lives of those in one's flock. He says, the Sun of Freedom has risen over Syria today, he said. We are part of this nation and deeply rooted in it. Let us not forget that Christianity originated in this land, and it was here in Antioch that believers were first called Christians. To all our people, I say, return to your homes and your work. Life must move forward. May the Lord bless and protect everyone and grant us leaders who can guide Syria to safe shores. So yes, it's a bit strange to see this. And as for France becoming a protector, which is of course preposterous, not least because of the interests of France in this region. I've seen it mentioned, I can't remember if it was Alistair Crook or perhaps Kevork Almasyan, an Armenian Christian from Syria, who I believe is now in Germany. One or the other of them, forgive me that I can't remember which, had pointed out that it's very likely that France had quite a bit to do with this latest offensive by the putative rebels moving out of Idlib, probably based on, you know, some of that historical background in terms of being a power in the region. As for the business with the Russians, in preparation for this stream, I watched last night one that Hitman had done recently with Hunger Merchant, the Hunger the Die Merchant. And they went into some of the historical background of Russia and the region. Of course, subsequent to or following upon the Treaty of Kuchuk in the 18th century. And the Russians poured lots of money and investment into this region, schools, hospitals, and they took seriously, it would seem, very seriously, it would seem, their role as protectors of Orthodox Christians in the area. But I made inquiries with a Lebanese Christian about whether or not there are any power blocks in Lebanon. I didn't ask specifically about Syria, but I assume it would be a very similar situation. If there are any power blocks there that remained that had any ties to Russia, of course, in Syria, you have it with Alawites. But in terms of Libya, though there is this vestigial, you know, sort of nominal, excuse me, Libya, Lebanon, though there is this vestigial awareness, maybe more than vestigial awareness of the role of Russia in the past in the region, the impression of the person I talked to was that there's no real remaining Russian influence on the coast there, other than that strip in Syria with the Russian air base and the naval facility. So it does not seem that Russia is in a position to do much with Lebanon, which I think we'll get to this when we talk about what might happen next. Lebanon is going to be the next state to fail even more than it has thus far, I would imagine. And so the question of Lebanon will become intertwined with all of this. But the basic way it was described to me by this Lebanese Christian was that there's really no way for Russia to reach into this region other than the ways we're aware of, the former relation with the Alawites and the presence of the bases there. Because in large part, Syria and Lebanon had been sort of apportioned out to be places that were under, well, Syrian until the regime fell, and Iranian influence. And with this movement, you know, as many people have observed, all the overland corridors have been cut for logistics and supplies. And so Iran has effectively been cut out of this region. And what influence Russia wielded in places like Lebanon was very likely sort of indirectly indirect and shared or conducted via Iranian connections. So, yeah, we'll have to see what happens there. There are Alawites, of course, in that Latakia area. And as I understand, there's maybe 100,000 of them a bit south of there in northern Lebanon. That in terms of your vision for what's likely to happen in the future here and how grim it's likely to be, I have to agree. And to your point about the breakdown of central power, making the entire question of whether or not religious minorities would receive protection when the state has no centralized existence, and and to whatever extent it might, and here it doesn't even exist, it can't project any power out into these other areas because they're dominated by other groups. And as you know, in the Northeast, I think the greater part of the Kurds there are atheistic Maoists who've been backed by the United States for their own interest. The Turkish forces that have been sent down, that had been trained in Hatay and had grown their numbers in Idlib, are essentially mercenaries. And to the point of, or relative to Libya having been mentioned earlier, many of these mercenaries have been shuttled back and forth by the Turks, often probably in the interests of their allies in NATO. They've been shuttled back and forth by the Turks between Libya and Syria. And so the idea that Syria is going to end up for quite some time like Libya or worse, or as you said, like Somalia, there's quite a bit to that idea, simply because the parties involved played a direct role, many of them personally, in keeping Libya looking like a dog's breakfast. And then there's the other issue. I know you're familiar with the historical Başbozuk, the broken heads, the Turkish irregulars that are were used in places like, you know, Habsburg territories, or in the course of many of these spats with the Russians in the Caucasus in the 19th century, and certainly in Ottoman activities south of Anatolia. The Başbozuk are essentially bandits, very often savage bandits, who are sent in with the express role and vision for them by the Turks of terrorizing the population. And the Turks have been using them in this fashion for a couple of centuries at least. So, and I don't recommend that anyone should go out and do this, but if one reviews the kind of clips that are available on the fringes of the internet of the kind of things that are done to people and have been done to people in places like Afrin or whatever in the northwest of Syria, when these Başbozuks or, you know, SNA forces or whatever were sent in, they're grisly. They're very, very grim indeed. And, you know, the Christians, you know, they're not just in Damascus, as I'm sure you know, AM, the largest community of them, you know, in terms of what had been surveyed historically, who knows what's going on now, they're in Aleppo. And Aleppo is the area that, you know, was first taken after these forces moved out of Idlib. There are also a number of them who are, excuse me, pardon me, who are in the north east of the country, in the areas that are controlled by the Kurds. But of course, the Turkish-backed forces are even now attempting to move eastward and to push the Kurdish forces back east of the river there. So they're literally cut off from being able to get to the coast or to be withdrawn. Many of the pleas that you can see in the Christian resources are coming from the leaders of these communities saying, look, can, you know, whatever the international community can do, the first thing we want is to open up the corridors for us to be able to get out if we don't want to stay here. So there's every indication that there's going to continue to be fighting, that it could reach levels of intensity that we only saw, you know, in the early days of the so-called Arab Spring and the dissolution of Syria. You've also got issues with I think one division worth of soldiers escaped across the border into Iraq with much of their equipment. Those people could come back. Again, there's already the fighting between the Turkish-backed forces and the U.S.-backed forces across the northern part of the country. The Israelis, you know, are annexing the high ground. I think they took the highest point in Lebanon now, which allows them to set up their radar and listening stations and the rest much more effectively. They're flanking Lebanon, by the way, and the Shiite forces of Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon as they do so. So it promises to be a very grim picture indeed. And there's no indication that I've seen, perhaps you've seen differently, but I doubt it. There's no indication I've seen that the West is really taking any interest at all in the fate of Christians there. As I just said, looking at the Catholic News Agency reports, despite what the nuncio said, it's all this, you know, keep your chin up, the future is bright type talk, which is so inaccurate as to seem, there's something very ugly in saying such a thing at this time.
Well, it serves both parties, doesn't it? It serves, I mean, I hate to say this, but given the number of bishops vis-a-vis parishioners, it is clear that, as we see with the fact that the army was stood down so quickly, I think it might be fair to say that, again, we're all saying this given the fact that all the situation is in flux, it's developing. But again, it's possible that certain assurances were given individually to the protection of these people, you know, whether they're monetary incentives or bribes, we don't know. But from the West's point of view, I find it very ugly, as you say, because they need to justify the fall of Assad. So isn't it convenient that you have this quote-unquote reform terrorist coming out and saying, oh, look, you know, we've made all these assurances, you know, we're going to protect these groups. And then the priests come out and they say the same thing. Whether they're sincere or not is anyone's guess here. But the point is, again, it confirms to the world that the deposition of Assad was worth it. It was justified in order to sate essentially the West's outcome. And again, I've been thinking a lot about this recently. It's something that I find really repellent, but it really has stuck with me since I believe it was the killing of Saddam Hussein. You know, obviously, I am not a fan of Saddam Hussein by any metric, but that's not the point. The point is, it was the way in which his assassination was conveyed to the American people in that press conference. You know, we got him. Because it really has informed, I think, a lot of Western politics going forward since 9/11, which is effectively scalp politics, you know, as if we're, I don't know, fucking cavemen or whatever, where it's enough simply to depose these axis of evil personalities that we've created. You know, we have created the Legion of Doom, or we've created this panoply of, you know, figures which are there to be digestible for sort of public hate, etc. And so Assad's deposition is good, irrespective of the outcome. And, you know, I find that absolutely despicable. But you mentioned quite a few things there. You mentioned the situation with Bashir Bazouks. You mentioned the situation with Turkey. Saddam Hussein, sorry, Osama bin Laden, in case I'm getting that few confused. Saddam Hussein was executed. Osama bin Laden was assassinated. But anyway, sorry if I'm getting that confused. But anyway, going on.
If there's any question about the general fate of these kinds of figures, there is, the apposite example of Gaddafi being sodomized with bayonets. Yeah.
Yes, so, exactly. Yeah. But, well, no, there are many examples you can draw, but it again, effectively, is this example of scalp politics. But I wanted to go back to this point you mentioned, which is obviously Israel and Turkey are the main beneficiaries from this. You've already mentioned the fact that the Israelis are encroaching upon Lebanon's territory to the east and using that to cut off all access from Iran to resupply Hezbollah, etc., and basically annihilate the influence of Shia militias there. And obviously the Turks are mainly concerned with the liquidation of the Kurds, as you mentioned, sort of Maoist atheists, even though there is a component of that in which many, from a Christian point of view, many Kurds are actually married into the remnants of the Assyrian Chaldean populations, in which essentially it was convenient for the survivors of the Sifo, the survivors of the Assyrian genocide, to eschew their faith and basically merge into Kurdish society or Turkish society, depending on where you were. But in the case of this, we have Turks in the north, Israelis in the south. I think if I'm going to try and find a caveat for the situation of Christians in Syria, you mentioned the fact that Aleppo had a large contingent of Christians. Like I said, this proliferation of various patriarchs and bishops, etc. One of the things I find rather disturbing is that HTS came out of this little enclave around Idlib, which is bordering Hatay, which of course is the origin point for the expansion essentially of what you can say were in many cases a mercenary outfit off to depose the Assad government. But Christians had basically already fled Idlib before this excursion began a couple of weeks ago. And of course, Christians fled from Aleppo, Christians fled from Hama, they fled from Homs. And as we've seen across the entire sort of scope of the Syrian civil war, the ones that haven't fled the country have fled to the Alawite majority areas. They have fled to Tartus, they have fled to Latakia in the west, and of course, in some cases, Damascus in the south. And like I mentioned, the Valley of the Christians linking those two regions together. And we mentioned at the beginning this idea of the strange bedfellows between the Muslim Shia group minorities along with the Christian minorities. So I guess there might be a possibility that as the central authority in Syria collapses, as this pro-minority regime under Assad has now fallen, that we may see the prevalence of warlords in this region, tribal warlords. But there could perhaps be a rump, either independent or autonomous area carved out for the Alawites in the West. Because as much as you can perhaps say that there are ISIS-affiliated groups or Muslim terrorists or Sunni Arabian nationalists who would love to fulfill that idea of Alawites to the coffin, Christians to Beirut, it looks as if, again, that they don't have the resources, they don't have the numbers, they don't have the zealotry, and they don't have the international backing in order to be able to carve out a Taliban-esque state concurrent with all of the legally established borders in Syria. So, like I said, one possible outcome for the remaining Christians in Syria is that we see a Alawite Syrian Christian enclave on the western coast. And of course, you mentioned Lebanon. This would also basically act as apposite Lebanon. This would essentially represent some form of Syria-Lebanon within the borders of a greater Syria. Do you think that's fair to say as a possibility?
Yes, it's in fact the one that I'm considering, but everything about that hinges on the idea of the military installations that Russia has on the coast remaining in place. And I can't get into it here. I've gone into it in past streams, and I covered it to a limited extent in that last one that you mentioned that I live streamed on the eve of the total collapse. But the basic idea is that you've got Turkey coming down from the north, and you've got Israel coming up from the south. And it seems to me that there is a coordinated program to pinch off the non-Western aligned countries of the Levant, and here meaning specifically Syria and Lebanon, to pinch them off and contain them. The coastal areas there, as you know, have already been cut off from the east, which is where the energy production is for Syria, and some of their most important farmland. That's under the control of the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they style themselves. There's a larger game going on here, I believe, that has to do with East Mediterranean natural gas, energy in general, and the need for Europe to secure for itself an energy supply that does not come from Russia. And the entire adventure in Ukraine seems to me to be primarily about setting up Europe on a stable footing from their perspective, from the perspective of the regime in Brussels, get its energy from someplace close that's not subject to interdiction and doesn't come from Russia, and also hopefully energy that is coming in at a lower cost than bringing in liquefied natural gas from the United States, which they've been trying to do as well. So there's this large amount of energy in that region that can be used to address to some extent these needs of Europe. And before Biden came into office, Netanyahu had been working with Egypt and other countries in the region, trying to work things out with Cyprus to really get something going. Turkey was against it. Turkey seems to be interested in getting in having as many energy pipelines that go to Europe and to the West as possible to come through them, because of, you know, the desire to historically be the bridge between Europe and Asia, you know, Istanbul being on both sides of the Bosphorus, as it were. So it depends. This coastal strip is going to be something that that I think the Turks and the Israelis would like to reduce or pinch off entirely. Whether leaving state borders up or not really doesn't matter. But from the Israeli perspective, if they can simply establish control to whatever degree in Lebanon, perhaps just forcing them to have to work through Israeli companies to export, or first exploit and then export their energy reserves. I think all of that is something that we're going to have to look at in terms of the future of this coastal enclave. The only other thing that we can do is take a look at the news reports that are coming out about whether or not Russia has plans to maintain its bases there on the coast. And as of a few hours ago, we're still seeing the same sort of information about how, you know, it looks like they might be leaving those bases, but there's no word from the Kremlin. There's talk of things being loaded up and removed and weapon supplies being secured. It does seem to be fairly sure that the ships there that Russia had at the port have been have left their berths and are some 8 kilometers out to sea. But it's all very quiet right now. Not quiet, but it's there's no information that is reliable about which way that's going to go, one way or another. But as you say, or as you suggest, and as I tend to agree with you, we may see this sort of minority enclave on the coast that gets maintained so that the Western powers don't lose face utterly in terms of all these historical relationships with
Christians. I think I'm going to be even more cynical here. I think it might even be a matter of there's no deliberate face-saving mechanism or PR mechanism. It's simply an area which the central government will be too weak to enforce its rule. And this actually goes back to your point about pipeline diplomacy. Is that one of the arguments from people who aren't just completely naive and obsessed with this phantom elusive concept of democracy happening, like the original sort of neocon Bush dream back in 2003, is of course the economic sanctions. The idea that Assad was holding back the economic development of Syria and peace because of the sanctions which were imposed by the West, which again is part of the argument for why towards the end of the regime, Assad was appealing to the Gulf states to normalize those relations in terms of appealing both to Iran, to Russia, and the Gulf. Of course, they were looking to Qatar as one of the main sources of oil, an oil pipeline, essentially through Syria. Again, that would conform with that idea. But again, all of this is to imply, this is a fantasy in my view, because all of this is to imply that there will be a government in Syria which is stable enough to be able to create the economic conditions to reverse the stagnation and the chaos during the Syrian civil war. And I believe that's impossible. I believe that Turkey has massively overextended itself. I mean, it's unable to deal with the Kurdish population within its own borders, let alone basically take control as a suzerain for northern Syria, in the same way that Israel is also massively overextending themselves in terms of the West Bank, in terms of Gaza, in terms of Lebanon, and now in terms of expanding into Syria. So the more that these powers expand themselves, they're basically seeming to eschew the idea of state building in the conventional sense, and they seem to be adopting a hardcore sort of return to imperialism sphere of influence policy. I believe if Syria is going to be mixed into all of this, I don't believe there is going to be this economic Hail Mary, which some Christians seem to believe is worth the fall of the Assad government. But as for the remnant, the supposed possible Alawite and somewhat Christian element that we see on the coast, I mean, in terms of looking at where the Russian situation is, obviously the Russians won't be able to legally maintain those bases if a recognized government doesn't give them the right to do so. And as you know, Russia is concerned with its international prestige, is concerned with BRICS, and it's also trying to position itself as the real protector of the rule of law in contradistinction to how it perceives the West. And so then maintaining a legal basis in the new Syrian government would be seen to be a detriment to that. Also, I think it would also be a potential sort of drain on their resources given the situation in Ukraine. So it wouldn't surprise me if they decided to cut their losses. And as for why the HTS aren't engaging the Russians at the moment, it could simply be they don't want to expend resources and creating flashpoints of the Russians. It'd be much easier for the Russians to leave on their own volition. But another interesting thing is, again, going back to my point I made earlier about the Treaty of Kuchuk, is what's going to happen to people who are seen to be collaborators with Assad. I mentioned the fact that the Catholics basically had feet in both camps. Well, how can you say, for example, reconcile someone like the Patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Patriarch of Antioch, John the Tenth, who visited Moscow, and Patriarch Kirill also visited Damascus. These figures who have been almost unanimous in their support, unequivocal in their support for the Assad government. Do these people really believe they're going to receive security from, again, quote unquote, reformed terrorist groups? Or are they going to flee across the country? Or are they going to try and rebase themselves, as we saw with the annexation of Hatay and the return to Damascus? Is there going to be some relocation of all of these patriarchal sees to somewhere like the coast? I'm not sure. But yes, as you say, there is a logic in using that Mediterranean base as an entrepot for establishing a European connection to oil through the Gulf states. There is also the possibility that Turkey would rather it go through its borders, linking up with the south and through Hatay. All of this is very interesting to consider. I think, because this is intended to be a long stream, it's very much intended to be a cap off for our previous discussion. Like I said, this is an evolving situation. We're all informed by historical precedent for this, and obviously that's been very much informing this discussion. But I want to go back to this idea of the refugee crisis. We're seeing already that governments across the West are trying to deny or create more sort of legal prohibitions on migrants entering into the West. And the issue is less for Christian migrants, because like I said, most of them have already fled Syria. What is left now is basically, is there going to be any patrimony at all for Christians in the heartland of the original Christian church, effectively? Are we going to see a complete erasure of that civilizational link that binds essentially early Christianity to modern Christianity? That is the sort of fundamental question we see. And I'm sorry to say, but I think Syria is now following in a pattern that we've seen elsewhere in the Middle East, whether it be Iran or whether it be Turkey or whether it be Iraq, where you have wholesale Christian populations, even self-identified nationality groups like the Assyrians and the Chaldeans, effectively entire communities, entire countries becoming refugees. There's also an Armenian contingent, I think, because during the Armenian genocide, most of them were moved to the Syrian desert. I've already mentioned the Armenian Catholic population, so this seems like there could be even more sufferings and privations which are being forced upon the Armenian population there, as we saw concurrent with the events in Nagorno-Karabakh. So in terms of like construing this, again, it could be possible that the ancient Syriac patrimony, all of these enclaves of Orthodox Christians relating to Greece or the Catholic communities, could all simply become expatriates. We're already seeing that there's virtually no likelihood of non-Christian Syrian refugees returning, because of course it's the situation in Syria is almost certainly going to get worse from now on. But I'm sort of looking at a situation where there will be no conditions during my lifetime, perhaps, where Syrian Christians will feel safe to come back. And if that is the case, then we see it, like, ironically, talking about Turkey and talking about the Bashi Bazouks. If Turkey is instrumental in this, then they have also been instrumental in something which is reminiscent of a horrific chapter in their own history some 100 years ago, which of course was the Sipho and the Kafno, the attempt to either fight, eliminate, or starve out the Christian populations in those regions. It seems to me that Turkey is, in many senses, in many respects, imitating a similar scenario when it comes to the Christian population in Syria. And if things don't dramatically change, and if there isn't a government which is seen to at least be capable of protecting Christians, I think we could see the elimination of that patrimony, as we've seen in Iraq, as we've seen in parts of Turkey, as we're also seeing in parts of the Gaza Strip, etc. I think all in all, perhaps the only sort of consolation to this is that many of them will just be able to find a slightly less worse situation in Lebanon. You've mentioned the situation in Lebanon. Of course, the situation in Lebanon is this example that I've been mentioning with the Alawite enclave on the Mediterranean, which is this power sharing agreement between the Druze, the Shias, the Maronite Catholics, and the Sunni Muslims. If it's possible, again, that we could see a further influx of Sunni Muslim refugees from Syria into Lebanon, and we could see a further demographic crisis like we saw following the war in 1867, when Palestinians again moved into Lebanon and they screwed up the delicate balance, which was the democratic premise of consociationism, the idea of the multi-ethnic democracy. But again, that almost makes Lebanon out to be some sort of paradise compared to Syria. You know, in Lebanon, at least, there is some sort of constitutional structure to allow for the protection of Christians. And there are still about over a million Christians there in Lebanon. But in the case of Syria, again, as far as the central government is concerned, I don't see any protections, again, other than the goodwill of whatever leader is basically able to win the power struggle in the ensuing years.
The only thing I would add to that is a possibility for this strip that runs from just south of Hatay to the southern part of Lebanon. Again, as you know, as our listeners know, the Turks have been moving south and outwards further from Hatay for years now. The Israelis have been moving north, you know, to annex areas like the Golan Heights and the rest. So they've narrowed this strip. But historically, and you know this very well, much better than I, the justification for interference in this region by Western powers historically has been predicated upon this, the idea of protecting their associated populations, you know, with the French being the protector of Catholics and other adjacent Christian groups, the Russians interfering or moving to protect the interests of the Orthodox and that sort of thing. Well, Israel has become sort of this primary Israel. Basically, the relationship of the United States with Israel, in certain, at least superficial respects, mirrors those older relationships. And so now it's like, well, there's a justification for the most powerful country in the West to constantly intervene in the area because of the existence of Israel, because that minority group needs to be protected. So it's sort of no longer necessary to keep a finger in the pie of the Christian communities in the same way. Indeed, it would seem to be against U.S. interests, and it would seem to be against Israeli interests for the West to take, you know, to get involved in any way in this region based on the fate of the Christians there, because it gets in the way. So it suits both the Muslim communities and the Israelis now to see these other communities taken off the board in terms of being a predicate for Western intervention. However, I don't know that it's impossible. I'll grant you it's unlikely, but I don't know that it's impossible that a country like France would, based on its pretensions, really, just its vestigial pretensions, I don't know that it's impossible that they would take some interest there and want to assert some role in Lebanon, and perhaps with this some sort of rump Syria, in order just to have a way to negotiate in the region and a way to feel as though there are still players there. You know, France has suffered a great deal in the Sahel now based on what I think is Russian tit for tat, driving them out and cutting them out of their profitable arrangements in that part of Africa. But the French do still have these global power pretensions, and perhaps, again, I'm not saying it's likely, we could see them step in to have some role there as a counterbalance. But, you know, there's so much in question about France itself, and the country is in serious financial trouble right now. So it may be that it's simply something that they can't afford at all, which is why I say it's unlikely. But you could see some sort of, you know, rump Syria being administrated in some relationship with Lebanon. But I think you're going to see U.S. companies and Israeli companies attempt to step in, even if there is some kind of border that remains, that will they'll exercise effective control, whether or not, you know, de facto control, whether it is in any respect de jure, doesn't matter.
Well, in terms of, just to answer your thing about the French, I mean, the French government has just collapsed. Barnier has resigned. The French parliament can't pass a budget. As you mentioned, they're in deep financial straits. Maybe Macron could use this as an opportunity to create some sort of personal prestige. But again, in terms of him being able to actually accomplish anything via that, even if he were to try, very much doubt it. Someone in the chat is saying the Maronites are not Catholics. What I mean to say is the Maronites are in full communion with the Catholic Church, which you really should know if you're critiquing that point of view. Yes, and I think this goes back to the point that we made on our last stream together, which is, if Iran was supposed to be in the position of de facto protectorship or evolving into that position for the sake of the Christians in Lebanon, not just in Syria, then the ironic thing is that as Iran, or rather appropriate thing is that as Iran is probably the biggest loser out of all of the powers here, I have various theories as to how the Russians will be affected, but that's neither here nor there for the purpose of the stream. But if Iran is the biggest loser, then by extension, Christians are also the biggest losers because they have lost that potential development with Iran. And of course, this plays into the dispensationalists, this plays into Israeli foreign policy, that of course the Christians are going to be expendable. Of course, the Christians are going to be a liability. At worst, they're going to be an enemy if Western foreign policy is backed by the dispensationalists, is backed to Israel's interests, and Israel's interests are to limit the scope of Iranian influence at its borders. And it seems that Israel is judging the situation according to that principle, and it is using the opportunity to brazenly violate Syria's borders. Whether the Israelis will have any interest in protecting Christians, I think, is as open to debate as whether the HDS is interested in protecting Christians. And again, we could also see a situation where the fate of Christians all across the Greater Israel area — what I mean by Greater Israel area, I mean legal Israel and the areas which are under Israeli occupation — whether the implications are that the state of Christianity within Israel-occupied territories will also deteriorate if Israel becomes overextended. There are a lot of knock-on implications here for this. But yes, any final remarks before we close this discussion?
No, I'd just say that everyone should pray for the Christians in this part of the world, because it's the one thing that we can assume with some certainty in these circumstances is that it's going to get worse, much worse, before it gets better.
Yes. Anyway, thank you very much, Oliver, for coming on at short notice. And thank you, everyone in chat. There aren't any super chats, so we can leave and get out of here early. All right. Thank you again, Semigorg, and thank you, everyone, for listening.